Welcome to A Cult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. This is episode number 159, featuring an interview with Guido Mina de Sospiro, author of The Metaphysics of Ping Pong, Table Tennis as a Journey of Self-Discovery. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. This episode is also made possible by additional donations from Steve and Lance via the donate button at occultofpersonality.net, as well as Max, Ryan, John, and Craig, who support the show via the A Cult of Personality Patreon campaign, available at patreon.com/occultofpersonality. I'd like to remind you that although you're able to listen to this podcast at no charge, the costs for me to bring it to you are significant. If you're able to spare some of your hard-earned currency to support A Cult of Personality by joining the membership section or donating via the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website or via Patreon at patreon.com/occultofpersonality, I can use your help. If you find these interviews interesting, informative, inspiring, and thought-provoking, please help me to continue bringing you this free podcast. And if you're already supporting the show and have done so in the past, thank you again. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center, located in historic Salem, Massachusetts, offers unique instruction in the arcane arts from some of the most experienced and talented teachers around. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center is committed to the authentic Western esoteric tradition by providing students with quality, in-depth classes, along with all the books and ritual tools one could ever want, many of them handcrafted. The ancient mysteries have a new home in the Witch City. Stop by the shop or visit online at hermeticarts.com. Temple of Thelema is a true outer order of the greater mysteries, providing ceremonial initiation, structured training, and regular group work, all in conformity with the principles of the Book of the Law. An investment of time, effort, and commitment is expected from each member. Each is expected to aspire fervently to the great work, to dare with courage undaunted, to perfect that work, and ever to apply his or her best effort to effect harmony within the order and within the world in general. Founded in service to the AA, College of Thelema seeks to guide the student to an understanding of the Law of Thelema. Most especially, this means a deeper understanding of oneself and of one's true will. A combination of instruction techniques is employed, including seminars, written texts, and individual work. For over 40 years, College of Thelema has published journals in The Continuum and Black Pearl, as well as several books on occult subjects, maintaining high standards in Thelemic education. Visit Temple of Thelema at www.thelema.org. Now, in episode number 159, an interview with Guido Mina de Sospiro, author of The Metaphysics of Ping Pong, Table Tennis as a Journey of Self-Discovery. The Metaphysics of Ping Pong is another wonderful work from Mina De Sospiro. Examining the cosmos through the lens of table tennis, he provides an unexpected tour de force that cannot be pigeonholed. The Metaphysics of Ping Pong is one of the most accessible books ever featured on this program, all while maintaining the loftiest of conversations with the reader. As an alternative to workbooks and how-to guides, this tale of initiation and the perennial philosophy is rather refreshing. Guido Mina De Sospiro has been fascinated by table tennis since childhood and regularly plays competitively. An award-winning, internationally acclaimed author, he has written 4 books published worldwide. Among them is The Forbidden Book, a novel co-authored with scholar of Western esoterica Jocelyn Godwin. I interviewed Godwin about The Forbidden Book in podcast episode number 121. Mina De Sospiro also maintains a blog on the New York-based web magazine RealitySandwich.com and the alternative views website Disinfo.com. Guido Mina De Sospiro, I want to thank you so much for joining us on a Cult of Personality podcast this evening. It's really a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners to the program may recall that a co-author of yours was previously on the podcast, Jocelyn Godwin, and you and he co-authored The Forbidden Book. So I would urge people to check that out after this if they're interested in hearing more about your work. But for people who may not be familiar with you, could you give us a brief bio and tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yes, I'm a writer. I write fiction and nonfiction. I write solo or with Jocelyn Godwin. We've written 2 novels together. And I hail from Italy originally, but at 20 I came to the States. I went to California at the University of Southern California, cinema production. And then I've been living in Miami and now in the Washington area. And I write in English, and this is the one we're going to be presenting tonight. It's my 5th book, and I've been published in 12 languages so far with multiple titles. So I have an unfamiliar approach, I suppose, to what I write. I like to stay between the esoteric and the exoteric, which is an age-old dilemma. I like to write for wide, big markets, but things that usually large readerships know nothing about. And I think that the book we're going to be presenting tonight is about that, because it's, you'll see what it is.
Yeah, so the book we're going to be talking about primarily is entitled The Metaphysics of Ping Pong. And, well, I think your description was certainly apt. There's a tension, I think, maybe tension's too strong a word, but there's the esoteric and the exoteric, and I find the way that you approach this subject is unique in my experience. I'm not even sure exactly what I would call this book. It's almost like a memoir in some ways, but the subjects you are actually writing about are much more universal.
Yes, it seems you would say that. Let me give you a little background. This is what happens usually in my books, because I seem to come from planet Venus or something. So usually in today's contemporary market, when you write a nonfiction book and you intend to have it published by a major publisher, you don't write a book, you write a proposal.
Right.
And then you go to an agent with this proposal, and the agent submits it to editors here and there. So that's what I did. And nobody had a clue of what I intended to do. Although the proposal was long and rather thick and, you know, I think well written. Okay, so I went ahead and I wrote 1 sample chapter, and we resubmitted. They still didn't have a clue. Then I wrote another sample chapter, and they resubmitted. Not a clue. Then I wrote the whole book. So now, even if I write, I just wrote another nonfiction book, I skip the process altogether, I write it out directly because people don't have a clue. Now, the refreshing part about this is that I was meeting recently in Italy, in Milan, with a publisher who's going to bring this title out in the Italian edition next year. And he has said in an interview that what he likes are books that he cannot categorize.
Mm-hmm.
That coming from a publisher is more than rare, because publishers are obsessed with a category, a tag now for the internet world.
Right.
They need to write this and that. And some books are farcical, because in the back you see 25 different genres with a dash in between, like travel, adventure, memoir, this and that. So my book was a way of introducing people who may not be aware of what the Philosophia Perennis is mm-hmm. to the Philosophia Perennis, by way of a sport or a pastime with which everybody in the world is familiar. And of course, the juxtaposition of the lofty with the silly, the metaphysics with the ping pong, is the whole idea of the book. That it is unusual that something as perceived anyway as an arcade game or a basement game or anyway a pastime could be the vehicle for me to describe or to speak about various strains of the Philosophia Perennis in the book, but I do.
And quite well, I would say. Maybe for listeners, it would be helpful if you wouldn't mind giving a synopsis of the book from a more superficial perspective as your journey through the discovery and becoming proficient at the sport of table tennis.
Yes. All right. Quickly, the whole thing began. I mean, I used to like it when I was a teenager, but I never did play it at the levels I'm playing it now, because there was something else to do all the time. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, we were driving in California with two of our sons, teenagers at the time, and we ended up at the Henry Miller Memorial Library in Big Sur, California, which is a place I love. I've been there several times because Henry Miller himself, towards the end of his life anyway, became very interested in esoterica and wrote interesting books, at least in part, which were quite a departure for him anyway. And at the Memorial Library, under the Redwood, there's a ping-pong table. And so one of our sons had been a little complicated, rather. We said, look, I'll challenge you at ping-pong, whatever, sure. And then he beat me. And I thought I was a great player. And, you know, there was nothing I could do. He just beat me. And we dropped it right there. So I came back to the D.C. area a couple of months later, and I decided that I would explore the world of ping-pong. So I went on the contemporary prophet, which is Google, and found a community center nearby where ping pong was played for a couple of hours every evening, and I went, and I stepped into another universe, because most of the players there were Chinese, and they were playing like acrobats, like something I had never seen. I realized I didn't know what table tennis was. I had no clue. I didn't know how to read their spin, nothing. And I could have dropped it right then and there, because, of course, it was very embarrassing. They were just walking all over me, incidentally. I mean, there was no way that I could send the ball back in any way. Or I could have stuck it out and gradually learn how to play with them, and that's what I did. In the process, I came across players from all over the world, from Madagascar to Mongolia, from Peru to Thailand, et cetera, because it happens to be a very cosmopolitan sport, and the D.C. area is also very cosmopolitan. And it's difficult to find only Americans when you go to a ping-pong club. It's always a big mix, of course, with a lot of East Asians, but not only. And there was something about the sport which resonated in me, because I have a background in esoteric, of course, not just Western, but also Eastern. And something happened, for example, in the 50s. Before that, the type of table tennis that Henry Miller used to play, or George Gershwin, or Arnold Schoenberg, they all play with hard bats. Now, hard bats had the pimples out on the rubber, and they had no sponge, so basically it didn't produce a lot of spin. So when it got to a high level, players would just go on and on and on with rallies that never ended, because there was no way of really placing a winner, really. It was a matter of sending it back and forth. It was very boring. But then something happened which I call the sandwich revolution. In the 50s, this Japanese player came up with a sponge racket, which produced incredible amounts of spin, as well as speed, because it catapulted the ball out of the racket. And then the International Table Tennis Federation stepped in. They decided that the new racket should be a mix between the old and the new. So they brought back the rubber, but they put the sponge beneath it. The rubber was inverted, so it would still give a lot of spin. And since then, table tennis entered a new dimension, because spin became the main element of the game. Now, when you play a game that is so much centered around spin, you no longer send straight balls. You always send parabolas, parabolic balls, and it's always curved trajectories, and the ball spins oddly, kicks up, or it dips down, or it goes to the side, etc. All of that reminded me of what? Of non-linear thinking. Now, unfortunately, in our society, in the Western world, despite Heisenberg, despite quantum mechanics, despite the theory of chaos and many, many other things which are recognized the world over, nevertheless, essentially, the parameters in the Western world remain strictly reductionistic and materialistic and linear. And we're very much concerned with causality. So if there is a cause, there is an effect. And therefore, for me to meet a game in which everything was so odd, in which the ball never flew in a straight line, in which you had to learn to read the spin, the incoming spin, if you wanted to stand a chance to send the ball back, all of that, I thought, aha, this is a different world. This is not the world we usually live in. This is not the linear world that the moment I leave here, I'm going to get into my car and it's going to be the linear world again. But for that 1 hour or 2 hours that one spends playing table tennis of that level, then it's a different world.
Yeah, I really love the analogy, how you bring the reader into that world with you, and there's just so many life lessons there, you know, that you can translate for, also from the world of esoterica. I'm wondering, maybe a good place to start is, you mentioned Philosophia Perennis, and for people listening who aren't familiar with that term or what that means, maybe you could just give us a little bit of background.
Yes, Philosophia Perennis is essentially translates to perennial philosophy. Aldous Huxley put together a very wonderful anthology of perennial philosophy in a wonderful book by the title Philosophia Perennis, in which he excerpted passages from different treatises from the world over, be the Tao or be Sufi stories or whatever, trying to explain and to show that great traditions the world over essentially aimed at the same objective and explain the same things through different rules, parables, examples, and words. Now, this is the type of philosophy that usually is not taught at school. The only philosophy that would be part of the perennial philosophy is Plato and Neoplatonism, certainly, the various types of Neoplatonism that existed, first in Alexandria, then in Florence, and then, one could say, also in England. But basically, there are analogies and parallels between, in my opinion, the Tao and certain ideas of Plato. That would be an example of perennial philosophy. It doesn't matter where it comes from, it doesn't matter how far apart it originated in the world, it says the same thing. And I think that what happened to philosophy ever since its great beginning in the West, I'm speaking, I mean, of course, Pythagoras and Socrates and Plato, it doesn't really get any better than that. And then, unfortunately, Aristotle won over, and we've had this Aristotelian slant ever since essentially the days of the Metaphysics, written by Aristotle, which confuted Plato's Metaphysics and promoted common sense, essentially. A hell of a lot of observation and common sense. Now, common sense can be very short-sighted. One thing that materialists tend to uphold to this day, and empiricists, is that all there is what meets the eye. My reply to them usually is not that I've seen ghosts or anything, because I haven't. My reply is, good, never wash your hands again. You don't need to. There are no microorganisms. You're never going to get sick. I mean, we're at this level. These people have a very atrophied brain, And they do not want to understand that there are things that we cannot see with the naked eye that nevertheless exist. And we know it through the instruments we have invented. Both the microscope and the telescope show us that there are things that we don't see or perceive, but they're there. Now, this seems obvious, but we live in a world in which that is not the case. So it's very refreshing to go to a table tennis club in which many languages are spoken, or in fact none, because there are too many languages to babble. The only language spoken is ping pong. And there is a clash of civilizations, for example. You see how we Westerners perceive reality, and then you see how Chinese, for example, perceive reality, and it's another world. And I will explain how later, because that's another subject.
Yeah, it's just, there's so many different levels of exploration. I think one of the things I'd like to start is by thinking about some of the points you raise in the book, which really scream out for emphasis, I think. You make a point about talking about the importance of humility, and I'm just wondering if you could spend a few minutes talking about humility, both in the exoteric and certainly in the esoteric sense.
Okay. Well, all right. So I need to introduce here, which happened to me, in fact, at the beginning of my adventures in the world of ping pong, the concept of initiation. Initiation from the Latin simply means to begin. It's a commencement, it's a beginning. And that is a concept that has been lost, of course, because the traditional world wanted it, and in the modern world you don't necessarily have it anymore. There's a lot of talk about mentors, but you know, it's not the same, because a traditional teacher was not encouraging, was a very hard fellow to follow and to obey. And anyway, initiation means that if you want to succeed at something, you got to start at the very beginning, because you don't know anything about, in this case, table tennis, but it could be the violin or whatever. And you have to realize that you will be subjected to a lot of humiliating instances, especially when it's a game that's based on points and winning and losing such points. Luckily for me, the various Chinese teachers, let's call them, with whom I played at the beginning, especially for the first 6 months, I mean, it was a disaster. It was a debacle every time I went. But little by little, one learns. Now, if you don't have humility, it's just not going to happen. You're going to drop out, and you're going to miss out on everything that you could possibly gain from, in fact, continuing to endure until you improve. And there are rite of passages. Of course, this sounds all preposterous because it's, after all, silly table tennis, ping pong. But much of there are rites of passages. Like, for example, the first time you defeat a Chinese player. Well, that's a rite of passage. For me, that was certainly a rite of passage, because when I first began to go to that club, I had no clue what this particular player was doing. And then after that, you go to a better club, and you start playing with some people with whom you lose regularly, and then 6 months later, you defeat them. That's another rite of passage. Then you say, okay, now I'm going to go to a tournament. You go to a tournament, and you lose your games, you win your games, but it's the first time, and you realize, well, you know, I can have my say here too. And then you go to a team tournament, and it's another rite of passage, and on and on and on. And the book ends with my going to China, which is basically the mother of it all, and playing. Well, first of all, I went to buy a special racket in Shanghai, which, by the way, they're very inexpensive. That's another great thing about table tennis. It's not like skiing or anything. It's really cheap. So even very good equipment doesn't cost much, and everybody can afford it. But anyway, and then I went back to the hotel, whatever, and there was a ping pong hall, and I went there playing, and that, well, I'm not going to give away the whole story, but that was the ultimate rite of passage. Not that in the end I do explain that I, although things went well, I didn't feel that I was stronger than the last opponent I played with. I just thought that, you know, things went well. But at the end of the whole excursus, if you will, from going to a community center and being beaten 11-0 in every game to playing in China with, you know, if not professional, certainly provincial players, in other words, players coming from the provinces, and I'm not a spring chicken, I'm not exactly 23, you know, it wasn't about winning, it was about having learned how to approach the world of forms, as Plato called it, which is another chapter that it's the most philosophical chapter of the whole book. It's called Metaphysicians and Empiricists, and I explain what I mean there.
Hmm. So it's interesting, I think, the way you described your journey in this book, and I think this talk about humility, and you brought up this idea of teacher, and I think it's kind of a natural segue, because you actually point out that if you had been maybe more humble and willing to accept a teacher, you maybe some of those lessons that you learned harshly could have been avoided, but that's all part of life, I guess, is that we go through those things.
I mean, absolutely. Unfortunately, we're not really trained to recognize a teacher anymore. I mean, it's a do-it-yourself society. It's the instant gardening society. You know, it's the fast food society. So you think, really, I'm going to take lessons in ping pong? You know, it's like, eh. And then you realize that what you think was a shortcut becomes a long cut, because you don't acquire the fundamentals, you don't do the movements right, mm-hmm. and you pay for that. And, of course, it would have been simpler, come to think of it, to more humbly accept some tips from a... In this case, this man was actually a professional player in his youth, so... and take it from there. Because in the end, I mean, I ended up trying to play like him. Not that I succeeded, but anyway, I realized that his style was dictated not by wins, but by what is most effective. Mm-hmm. And what is most effective is also a lot of hard work. But yes, you're right. I mean, it's something that and you have no idea, precisely because of the fact that in the West you don't have the tradition that you have in China, in which table tennis is taught at school. People, especially the basement kings, I call them, the ones who play in basements, they come up with their own homespun style. And then they come to a club because they think they're very good. And it's very humiliating for them because the style that they developed at home in their basement, thinking it was a fantastic invention of theirs, just doesn't work. Doesn't work with real players. Does not pose a threat. And so... either they go back to the drawing board and they start over again, or they continue to play with that, and then they buy weird rubbers, anti-spin rubbers, this and that, long tips, trying to essentially add more shortcuts and therefore making them even a longer long cut. You see a lot of that. You see a lot of... I mean, first of all, the point is, and that's another point I make in the book, I guess, which is about playing. I call it homo ludens, that passage, playing man. Play is, in fact, very serious. It's one of the most serious things we humans do. And not only humans, also animals engage in playing. And although there may be nothing at stake, there may not be money or a bet, nothing, nevertheless, people, when they play, are very, very serious. And people who come to a club, who leave their work, and they come there, and they take time out from going to dinner or whatever, and they change. They do play at the very best of their abilities. And so everybody's very intent in playing, but some of them are just clearly wrong in their approach, not only to the game, but I think to life. I mean, philosophically, they're just holding themselves back. And that's where I draw the line between the metaphysicians and the empiricists, and I speak about Plato's The Allegory of the Cave, which is very famous.
So, in that chapter, you maybe I'm oversimplifying, but you kind of draw a distinction between, I guess you could say, personality types. People who view the world through the Aristotelian lens and maybe those who are more sympathetic to the Platonic mode.
Yes, well, I actually really do use the allegory of the cave, which is, you know, for people who may not be familiar with Odoi Dao, because your listeners are all very clever. But anyway, there are people living in a cave, and there's somebody doing shadow play on a wall through a projector, and the people in the cave think that that's reality. Then one of these people manages to escape through a secret passageway and go up and out of the cave. And he experiences reality in a much more vibrant way. Everything is much truer. It is much closer to the world of forms, which we would better translate with the world of archetypes. Now, this gentleman comes back into the cave to tell his friends and relatives that he's seen actual reality, the real world of forms, not what they think is reality, which is just shadow play on a wall. And they nearly lynch him. Who is he? Okay, now, the world of forms, when you think about the word form, there is correct form in every sport, in every discipline, in playing the violin or the guitar, whatever, and then there isn't. Now, if, of course, it's difficult to possess oneself of perfect form, but the more you do it, the more not only do you become a better player, but you do approach a world that you thought was not open to you. Now, I'll give you an example. Sometimes, now I'm not an amazing world-class player. I'm pretty good. I've got a ranking, but I'm not saying that I am, you know, a champion or anything. However, sometimes I may happen, or somebody at the club may happen to offer a rally with an opponent whose level is so high and so very much like what it should be, in other words, the level of champions, that at the end of the rally, regardless of who won the point, the two of them look at each other and say, "Did you see that? Where did that come from?" Because the very players who just did that rally cannot believe it, that they actually were so close to true form. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what seems like just simply a silly winning or losing a point, it's a lot more if it's a beautiful and spectacular rally that belongs more in the realm of champions rather than in the realm of people who play ping pong as a pastime, because after all, that's what we do. So there is that. And there is empiricism. Empiricism, in the case of table tennis, denies the existence of spin altogether. Now, spin is the most beautiful element of table tennis because it makes it non-Euclidean. I used to play in London with Rupert Sheldrake, who is a philosopher of science, a very controversial philosopher of science, because he introduced, according to the magazine Nature, magic into science, and so his books were banned, etc., which was a great publicity stunt for him, so good for him. But anyway, he's a great guy, and I turned his children on to table tennis once he visited us in Italy. And then they made him buy a table tennis table in London. And then every time I went to visit, I had to play with him. And he became a good player, too. And he wrote to me saying that one of the striking things about that type of table tennis, which is the one play with the sandwich rackets and a lot of spin on every ball, is its essentially non-Euclidean characteristics. I mean, as I said before, it doesn't bounce in straight angles. It's about a parabolic world in which everything is curved. So now the empiricists wish that sandwich rackets had never been invented in table tennis. They would much rather play with hard bats of yesteryear. And in fact, there are tournaments only for hard bats. Now, a hard bat produces hardly any spin. So basically, you're just, you know, playing with a clipboard. You're sending the ball back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until somebody makes a mistake. Very boring and very uninteresting. That's never going to get you any closer to the world of form. So it's this conscious rejection of the most mysterious and beautiful element of the whole sport that defines, in my opinion, these people. And there are not many, but there are. people who go out of their way to buy anti-spin rubbers or rubbers with long tips that reverse the incoming spin, so they make it difficult for the player to respond to that. I mean, there are. Because they just don't want to learn form. I mean, it comes to the point that, you know, we just don't like to play with them. We just say, okay, I'll pass. Because it's no fun anyway. It's all about trickery, you see. It's not about doing the right thing. And but they're grown men, you know. They just don't want to learn.
Now, I hesitate to ask, but would you mind extending this into the esoteric and maybe... I think we all know who plays what roles here, but maybe you might like to talk about that a little bit.
Well, clearly, the metaphysician is the one who tries to explore the world of forms.
Mm-hmm.
And the empiricist is the one who simply sticks to his sensory experiences and just doesn't realize the riches that could unfold if only he or she played the way that the game allows to be played. I mean, let's not forget the strangest thing that, you know, table tennis was born as an imitation of lawn tennis, basically. And then when the sandwich revolution occurred, topspin was developed very much by table tennis, and it was tennis then that imitated topspin from ping pong. However, you know, the ball is bigger and heavier, so it doesn't rotate nearly as much as it does in table tennis. The table tennis ball is very small and very light. It rotates hundreds of times per second. So the bounce is very unpredictable. And another factor, for example, kicks in about the esotericism, which is if you hit what we call a good shot, and you know, a difficult but technically demanding but good shot, and you make a point, you say that was a good shot. Your Chinese opponent say, no, that was a lucky shot. He said, wait a minute, I wanted to do that and I did it. And he says, yes, but that's a high probability shot. It's difficult for it to come through. So if it did come through, it's because you were also lucky. And that's a main difference between the West and the East. We see everything as cause and effect. They see everything as accidentality. It was accidental, which is the difference between what we study at school, Darwin and Newton, not the good Newton, not Newton the alchemist, but Newton the mechanicist, and they studied the I Ching, see, because that's the book of accidentality. And we're still stuck with causality.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you raise in the book, and it also, I think for me, raises some questions. And if you'll indulge me just a bit, because this is a digression from your book, but this cause and effect mentality that we have in the West, as you talk about. Mm-hmm. One of the ways that I see that manifesting in this East-West, the differences, is in the esoteric realm, where in the West, I'm much more likely to encounter esoteric traditions that say things like, it's necessary for man to circumscribe his passions within due bounds in order mm-hmm. to progress along the spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
But then if I look to the East, you do find that, but then you also find, you know, things like tantric traditions, which would tell you pretty much the exact opposite,
yes.
At least superficially. It seems very inconsistent with that cause and effect type of mentality. And
yeah,
I'm wondering
absolutely.
if you see some sort of correlation between that.
Yes, I absolutely do see a correlation between them. Because, I mean, one thing about the East, and even the Middle East, I'm thinking of the Sufis, for example, their way of attaining a different level of consciousness goes through a lot of nonlinear thinking and a lot of paradoxes. And the same can be said about Taoism and Zen. Whereas, unfortunately, in the West, you're true, you're right. Even our best writers are permeated by that type of mindset, which is causal. I don't know, I'm thinking even Julius Evola. I mean, his structuring of his reasoning is imperiously causal. It's not accidental. One who opened himself to this, of course, was Jung, who was the great popularizer of the I Ching in the West. And he noticed that, you know, it seemed to him that the I Ching was almost primarily concerned with accidentality. They had no interest in causality because maybe it's just too silly. I mean, of course, if I lift something and then I drop it, it's going to drop. it's that simple, you know. But the fact that, you know, the famous butterfly flapping its wings and then something else happening on the other hand of the earth, you know, that's not very intuitive, but it's true also. So yes, absolutely, I do find that, well, as my friend and co-author Jocelyn Godwin said, in fact, when you interviewed him, that he really likes the Tao most of all, but unfortunately he doesn't know Mandarin, and so because he knows a number of European languages, he concentrated on our own Western tradition of esotericism, which is rich, there's a lot of stuff, but I always feel that, you know, if you want to play the greatest ping pong, you go to China, and if you want to get the best esotericism, you go to the East. That's the way I feel, and that's the way he feels too.
Well, I think I'd agree. Everyone I talk to, I think, agrees, and I've made this point numerous times, but I think I can count on one hand the number of people who I've interviewed who don't have some kind of deep roots or lineage connection to Eastern traditions. So when it comes down to it, many of our Western teachers are, in effect, Buddhist or, you know, Hindu, or for whatever lack of a better description. And that's just the way it is. They've always gone to the East in search of more light, and that's not just metaphorical.
No, and then when you think about it, I mean, we had Plato, who was on the right path, and before him Pythagoras, who was also on the right path. And then came Aristotle, and not just him, and everybody else followed suit. And so we created the right thing, but then came the venom. It's not the other way around, the venom and then the antidote, you know? So we had it right here in Western culture. But, you know, and certainly when you think of the Neoplatonists from Alexander, Iamblichus, etc., Porphyria and so on, they were incredible. But one wonders up to what point were they really Westerners, you know, since they hail from Alexandria, and, you know, it was a different thing anyway. And, well, also, for example, in the 20th century, René Guénon, the traditionalist, went to Egypt and converted to Islam and became a Sufi. It's difficult in our Western world for some reason, you know, maybe we tend to think straight despite our trying not to, instead of thinking in curves, you know, and in a parabolic way. I don't mean parables, but parabolic and non-Euclidean and fourth dimensional. So it's a bit of a burden.
No, I think you're right, because I found that it was only once I began to study tarot and the Kabbalah that my actual thinking processes changed to the type of non-linear thinking that you're talking about. So it is accessible, but you're right, you know, it does sort of beg the question, because those traditions are, while they can be, they emerge publicly in the West, you know, their roots are also Eastern as well.
Yes, absolutely. It's just, it goes against everything we're taught. I mean, don't forget, you know, centuries of thinking that Thomas of Aquinas was the greatest. You know, Thomas of Aquinas had, famously, the four proofs for the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, this man went about rationally to explain the existence of God. That's the way these people used to think, you know, and at the time, and for centuries after him, they were sacrosanct, you know, it was just, and if you think of Attar, the Parliament of the Birds, you know, the Sufi poet, it's exactly the opposite. And in fact, there's a story in the book, which perhaps we'll reference in the next hour for your members only, a Sufi story that I was told, which very much has to do with what we're talking about. I was told it by a Lebanese who has heard it by a Syrian or something, a dervish. And I relate the story in the book. Now, of course, this man disappeared, so he just dropped this very, very, very thought-provoking story and then disappeared. So I never knew what it meant. And then I set about asking people whom I like, of very different extractions and ages, etc., around the world, what they thought the story meant. And everybody gave their explanation, and it was always rather paltry, I thought. And then I found this esotericist who explained what the story meant. And my goodness, it was an epiphany. It was incredible, and at the same time, it was very funny. So I think that perhaps in the next hour, for the members only, you may want to read the story. It's a short story. And then I'll tell you, for your benefit and for the benefit of your listeners, the members, what the meaning of the story is. Not that I say it is, but what this esotericist thought it was. And it will relate exactly to what we're speaking about now, but I cannot disclose it yet.
No, thank you. Yeah, I think that's a great idea. I had some thoughts on it myself that I'd like to ask you about.
Then you'll tell me the thoughts and see if you're right.
Yeah.
I didn't want to say this guy is right and wrong, but that's where I drew the line, because it is a book intended for people who may not be too familiar, and I don't want to confuse them too much.
So
it's something that your members will probably enjoy, but you cannot, you know, push it too much. You know, just give them. Yeah, the idea is you hint at all these different things that are going on with table tennis as a vehicle, really, of exploration, and then if they're interested, they will continue to find out, and it will be like a door opener. You know, it's not supposed to be ending itself. My goodness, it's 240 pages. You could write 24 million pages.
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to return to something you were just mentioning in this idea of the West sort of losing this thread of non-linear thinking, of more Platonic mode of being in the world. And one of the things I was curious about, and you probably have a better insight into this than many, is do you think that the primary reason that this happened was the way that a lot of scholars describe the situation within the Latin Church, whereby much of the sort of philosophy or wisdom tradition that you're talking about, Plato, Porphyry, Plotinus, Iamblichus, etc., was viewed as not only not Christian, but not even monotheistic in a sense. Even though they talk about the one, they were still Hellenists. And I guess I'm really wondering, was this a product of religious or theological phenomenon, or was this more philosophical divergence?
I think the two things went hand in hand. Because, for example, Sallustius, in the 3rd century, tried to wrote a treatise on man and gods, trying to bring back polytheism and paganism, really. But by the time he did, Christianity was making tremendous strides in the empire, in Roman Empire, and then he would have made them all over Europe, etc. And it became, we transitioned then from the religiosity of life to the religiosity of detachment from life. All the major Abrahamic religions are eschatological. They're all about what happens after death. Mm-hmm. They're not really concerned with the here and now. They exclude the possibility that superior knowledge can be attained here, or it's even worth trying. So that was the telos, that the Greeks would say, the project, in a sense, that came, that was formed. That was what the church, the direction of the church, the founding fathers of the church were horrible people, in my opinion. Tertullian, and before him, certainly, St. Paul. And slowly, the Aristotelian slant was co-opted by, Catholicism at the time was the only religion in the West anyway. And the two of them formidable allies, two thinking in a very constrictive way and linear, and going against, in my opinion, very much what the essence of the perennial philosophy is. And we've had centuries, and you know very well that whoever thought differently, like Giordano Bruno and others, you know, ended up at the stake. They were burnt by the church. And there were other people like, the Neoplatonic Academy in Florence, for example, Marsilio Ficino and Pico della Mirandola. They were very, very clever in disguising their esotericism with Christianity, mm-hmm. or else they would have ended up very badly too. Tommaso Campanella ended up for 17 years in a prison in Calabria until the next pope decided to free him and hire him as the magus at the Vatican. There was the pope doing that, because this one pope knew that maybe there may be something there, and Campanella was now doing incantations for the pope. But the fact is, we have, the Western culture and the Western, certainly the church, together with Aristotelian philosophy, have smashed and banned anything that was different from what they were teaching. And that's why we have a fantastic alchemical tradition that we are essentially unable to interpret. Because, as you know, alchemists, they had to write in symbols. They couldn't write, you know, what they probably wanted to write, because they, you know, every single book had to be go through the censorship and pass or not from the church, including the one we base the forbidden book on, which is the magical world of the heroes. So even though somebody said it's the highest alchemical treatise ever written, frankly, it's difficult to understand what these people were speaking about. And I'm saying, you know, great experts in the field are also puzzled. So, to make it short, yes, I think that the church, together with Aristotle, were the greatest enemies to the kind of non-thinking, I would say, that makes men closer to the essence of the truth, the true form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And without going too far down this road, but one final question, I guess, or looking for your insight on this is, with what you just said in mind, I think it's fascinating that modern traditionalism, or at least in the form of like Guénon and his followers primarily, as far as I'm aware, generally endorse at least Catholicism as one of the major sources of
tradition itself as a legitimate form of a spiritual path of initiation, in a sense, as opposed mm-hmm. to the idea of counter-initiation that mm-hmm. Many people often speak of nowadays.
Well, insofar that Catholicism is inspired by what existed before it, which is paganism, it sounds. Mm-hmm. Of course, doctrinal Catholicism is atrocious. I can't think of a better word. But folk Catholicism, in my view, is very pagan to this day. I've been to Peru, I've been to Guatemala, I've seen, first of all, the priest at the end of the Mass said, "And may the God be with you," not "May God be with you." And then, essentially, where the Mayas used to do their incantations on top of a pyramid, now that's a church, and they still continue to do incantations inside the church. So, in other words, as long as that's allowed, then yes, we're closer to the essence, because, you know, the gods represent archetypes. So it kind of makes sense. But mm-hmm. the superimposed idea that comes essentially from another continent, the imported religion of the single god, has always been very problematic. Very problematic. Also, because within Catholicism, of course, you've got the trilogy, which is a problem in itself. If you want to have a single god, then you have a trilogy. And then, of course, the Mother of God, Theotokos, the Holy Virgin, is far more important than Jesus himself. There are 10 churches dedicated to the Holy Virgin to one dedicated to Jesus in the world to this day. And that's nowhere in the Gospels, nowhere in the Bible. I mean, she's very, very secondary, a person, a figure in the Gospels. So that was all born as a grass movement, basically, a grassroots movement that tried to recapture the essence of what the Western world knew before this religion was imported and imposed. But yes, I agree. I mean, Guénon saw Catholicism as one of the traditional ways of initiation, but Evola called it a syncope of the Western world. mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He just detested Christianity. So, I don't know up to what point a traditionalist can endorse Catholicism, because it's, I don't think it helps much in the attainment of what, for example, Asian esotericism is after, or even alchemy, or even Platonism, etc. But then again, there are different ways of practicing, I suppose. So, that's also a possibility.
Yeah, that brings up an interesting point. I wanted to get back to the book. One of the things that you bring up in the metaphysics of Ping Pong, and you talk about how it's helped you to understand ping pong and table tennis as a game, is the I Ching. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about the I Ching and your experience with it a little bit.
Yes. All right. The I Ching is something that entered my life when a friend gave us a book with an introduction by Carl Gustav Jung. It was the first translation for the West of the I Ching by a German sinologist. And I began to experiment with questions, etc., to the I Ching. And I began to get a feel for it. And then I forgot about it and then set it aside and then just left it behind, I thought. And then when I began to frequent, there's one club, for example, in the vicinity of D.C. that I call the Chinese Club, because it's almost entirely frequented by Chinese players. The way they approach everything about the game, about life, reminded me very much about the I Ching, in which accidentality is the fundamental principle. I mean, essentially, you throw six sticks or six coins or three coins six times, and according to their arrangement, you get a vignette, which is supposed to represent where you are at present in the universe and the things that await you and how to avoid them or engage in them according to what you get. And then there could be also some broken lines, so there's yet more explanations which may contradict the vignette you got in the first place. And of course, this is like 5,000 years old, I Ching, and the thing is, for a Westerner who grows up with the idea of cause and effect, and he presses a cell phone and it's FaceTime and he's speaking and seeing somebody in New Zealand and he's in New York, and he knows that if I press this button, that's going to happen, throwing, you know, coins and accepting the verdict just seems completely, almost pathologically stupid. Now, I think it's up to the practitioner to understand whether or not that works, but I think that the I Ching themselves resent this sort of testing. If one is doing the I Ching to test their whether or not they're telling the truth or they're predicting the future, well, then the I Ching will do all they can for that not to happen. It's the same thing with telepathy. I mean, my friend Rupert Sheldrake is very much trying. He's been trying for years to do these telepathic experiments. And it seems to me that while most people, even in the Western world, will tell you know what, I kind of believe in it because I've experienced it at some point in my life. When you do it in a lab, it just doesn't happen. And that's a problem. And the same with the I Ching. If somebody approaches the I Ching as a fortune teller, the I Ching resents it. So it has to be approached as something very, very holy, with tremendous respect. Because, you know, one is channeling forces that one doesn't comprehend. And I suppose that if enough respect is shown, if one is familiar with the process and with the answers, which are, you know, sibylline at best, then one can make sense of it. And if you sparingly, you cannot do it every day or twice a day or something, or then it becomes a joke. But I would recommend it. I would recommend it as a practice, you know, as something to do. I mean, it's something that, again, like ping pong, anyone can do. It doesn't cost anything, you know. I mean, there's simple ways of, you know, you don't have to go fasting and climbing Mount Everest and speaking to Tibetan monks to achieve something transcendental, you know, that too. But there are other ways. And there's a whole discipline connected with, how would you say, consulting the I Ching in the proper way, which is not simple at all. And I think Jung was right with the way he popularized it. He was on the right way. I mean, at the end of his life, he used to maintain that he didn't cast the sticks anymore because he knew the outcome already. Well, that's typical Jungian self-aggrandizing style. But nevertheless, he probably had a point. He probably knew already, you know, having gained insights into his own realm. So I like them. I think it's, of all the books, that is probably the most important books in the book in the history of mankind. I don't, of the ones I know, anyway.
Well, that's
certainly something. Certainly it's the oldest.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if you have any thoughts about, we've talked a lot about the West and the East and the differences between the two. You approach these subjects through ping pong, through table tennis, which admittedly is dominated by the Eastern Asian players.
Yes.
But you make the point in the book, the game is worldwide.
Oh, yes.
And I think there's some lessons we could draw from that as well. Esoteric traditions are worldwide, and maybe in our experience, Easterners tend to have excelled in those realms in the same way they do with table tennis. But that doesn't mean that a Westerner like yourself can't learn and become more proficient and excel just as well.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, well, the realm of the martial arts, for example, that it's famously in the hands of the East Asians, and they do things that we can't even imagine. I imagine behind closed doors, we haven't seen them. And with table tennis, a lot of German and Scandinavian players go to China to train. And they live there for months on end, and they train with Chinese people. And they, too, become very proficient. I mean, the top 10 players in the world, there are a couple of Germans, you know, so they're getting there. And there was this Swedish guy about 10 to 20 years ago who was the world champion. He was just better than the Chinese. He was just incredibly. He was called the Mozart of ping pong. But yes, I do think that the door is open to us Westerners. I also have seen a lot of Middle Easterns at play. I also seen a lot of Muslims play table tennis from Afghanistan to Egypt, you name it, and they have their own school too, and they seem very intent and good. But I think for some reason it's the second participatory sport in the world after soccer. In other words, there are 400 million people who play table tennis in the world at different levels, of course. For some reason, it seems to be a universal language. I mean, you'd be surprised. I mean, sometimes some people would come to a club and they would say, "Where are you from?" And they would tell you this country you never heard of, like an island off the west coast of Africa or something. And so it could be that everybody is looking for something in it that it goes beyond the mere game. Because if you think about it, it's strange. We don't do it professionally. It's something that we do after work. We take out time from our families, from our dinners, from whatever, to go and play those 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours and get really tired and beaten up. And it's not the game itself. I remember reading a book about Ireland in which this English teacher was accepted to teach on the west coast of Ireland. And when winter came, he left Boston and he went to Ireland. When winter came, it was really dreary, rained every day, the light went off. I mean, it was always dark, etc. And he found this small pub in which was about 10 miles away from where he lived, where people on Thursday or something would go there and play Irish traditional music for themselves. There was no one in the pub except the players and the owner. And they would play hours and hours and hours and hours on end, becoming extremely proficient, but for no one. Now, it's not just for their own enjoyment. It's something else, doing it together. It's practicing an art. I know it can be seen as something, as a very exoteric endeavor, but at the same time, it could be seen as a very esoteric endeavor, too. Remember, they're not doing it for anyone. There's no public. When we go play ping pong, there's no one there except the people. In other words, it's not for show. It's just, and the amount of work that goes into it to become proficient, to become flawless, to approach the world of forms, is stupendous. And yet we do it. So I think, to various degrees, we're all cold towards the world of form. It's a calling.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I listen to you talk about this, the question also arises, we're drawing analogies between the world of table tennis and esoteric philosophy and practice. And I think the one thing that I'm having a little bit of, a question, and I'm not sure that the analogy breaks down, to be honest with you, but it's this idea of competition. Obviously, players are sort of in this internal competition to get better than they were before.
Yes.
But there's this outward, extroverted competition, which is just inherent to the game because you have to play against somebody else.
Absolutely, but it's completely silly. I'll tell you what, it's a very good point that you're making, by the way. I'll tell you what, my teacher and friend, Jaime Alvarez, who used to be a world-class player in his youth, and he played with the Dominican national team, and he went to the Olympics, etc., etc. So he was a world-class player. For some reason, there were 3 or 4 world-class players, including his brother, in that period in the Dominican Republic. plays not necessarily to win, although you always lose with him because he's very good. He plays to do the very best possible that he can do, and the most difficult. He challenges himself. He challenges the laws of physics. He challenges everything. He doesn't really care. There are points that he could easily win, but he takes the most difficult way, not the easy way. You'll never see him doing a chop or something like that, nothing. Mm-hmm. It's always the grand topspin. It's always a lot of movement. It's always the whole body participating. So in the end, he's not really playing to win. He's won enough in his life. He's playing to approach perfect form. Mm-hmm. And we're back again to the world of forms. He doesn't really care. Of course he will win every game. I mean, he's about 2,200 ranked, which is very high. I'm about 1,900. And, you know, the world-class champion is like 2,600. So he's very, very, very high ranked for somebody who doesn't do it professionally. And he doesn't care about winning the game necessarily, although winning is like, in a sense, an epiphenomenon of playing so well.
Right, right.
It comes with it, but it's not the main objective at that level. And so that's the level you want to achieve, in which it's no longer for, because, yes, as you say, it's inherent in the game, winning, etc., but it's internal. It's not external anymore. You don't really care about the point. You care about perfect form. You want every shot to be perfectly executed. So it's a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, if we could all emulate the master, I guess that would be the way to go.
And of course, you know, we cannot all emulate the masters, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of lazy people out there.
Oh, sure, yeah.
There's a lot of lazy people because, frankly, anyone can do. I mean, everybody can improve. I mean, I have the old saying, practice makes perfect, unfortunately doesn't really apply to table tennis, because I guess you have to have a certain dexterity and hand-to-eye coordination or something that some people just don't have, because they practice and practice and practice, but they really don't get very good. But I've seen other people who come there knowing very little about ping pong, and within a couple of years, they're very good. So, because they love it. And it's, I don't think they fall in love with the idea of winning the game as much as they gradually fall in love with the idea that they're approaching perfect form. I can't stress that enough.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because as I read your book and as I listened to you describe it, to me, in my experience, what you're talking about sounds a lot more like the way I felt skiing or surfing or riding a skateboard or something like that, because
yeah,
it was...
I was going to speak about skiing, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I mean, it was like this very primal energy engagement with the mountain or the wave or something like that, and being able to... It's not really about perfection, although it may feel perfect in a sense, but it's really about the moment and sort of maximizing your performance.
And channeling physics.
Yeah.
Be it the parabola of a spinny ball or a wave or the gravity down a mountain, it's just that. And the form has a lot to do with it, because you know very well that if you don't apply perfect form when skiing, bad things happen to you.
Oh, yeah.
Like falling. Although, I mean, I've also on the slopes, I've seen people with terrible form, and they still manage to get down the slope. But I think that once you get past that idea of a beach to the finish, once you get out of teenagehood, that's not what really matters. It's more like being in perfect communion with the elements and executing everything with perfect form. There's something about it that is just, as you said, transcendental and at the same time elemental.
Yeah, I agree. And it took me many years to get to that point, but I'm finally able to perceive that same thing happening with, for instance, with like ceremonial ritual or meditation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so much more subtle that I felt like it took me a much longer to appreciate it in that environment.
Yes, because for two reasons. First of all, there is the fact of, well, for example, skiing, there is speed, and there is hormones, and we're young, and there's the friend that you want to be to the finish, and all that. And then also, the sport itself, you don't think of it as ritual or ceremonial magic or something. You just think, it's just going down the slope. So there are two reasons why many people don't get to the level in which they say, you know what, I could approach this in a different way. But when you do it, well, of course, because of your interests in life, you probably find that, as I did, I mean, you know, when I went to play table tennis, it was a new experience at that level, and I found so many analogies with the world that is dear to me, which is the esoteric world, that I wrote a book about, because I thought there were just too many analogies, and it wasn't a coincidence.
Yeah, I'm very grateful that you did, and again, the book is The Metaphysics of Ping Pong, published by Quest Books. I'm assuming it's available at all of the usual outlets.
Yes, and those who are interested in buying it should know that it came out before in the UK, and for some reason that defies explanation, if you go on Amazon, that's the one they propose to you. But in America, it's a lot more expensive to buy the English import than to buy the American edition. So look for the American edition. By Quest Books, it's less expensive.
Okay, I'll try to make sure we get the right link up on the show notes. And maybe you can remind people as well where they can find you and some of your other writing online.
Well, yes, I have a website, which is guido.mina.d.sospiro.com at AOL. I mean, .com, that's it. And then, you know, I have a number of books out, the one you mentioned with Jocelyn Godwin. And then I have The Story of You, which is The Memories of a Tree, actually. And so they just go on Amazon and they find my page. Or they go to a bookstore, Powell's, whatever. And they'll find my page and my books.
Well, Guido Mina de Sospiro, I can't recommend your work highly enough. I think for anybody who's looking for books that are unlike any you've read before and will take you places that you didn't expect, and very enjoyably at that, I would definitely recommend Guido's work. And The Metaphysics of Ping Pong is really it's such an enjoyable read, and I found myself really relishing it. And I hope that other people will enjoy it as much as I did.
Yeah, so do I. Thank you.
So, and also, please stay tuned for the membership section conversation, where we're going to talk about a Sufi poet, or poem rather, which is quite fascinating, and I think the interpretations are probably just as fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think so too.
In the Occult of Personality membership section, Guido Mina de Sospiro and I discuss a Sufi parable that he was told, which seems to elucidate the nature of the spiritual journey and sovereignty, but perhaps not. We also discuss much, much more. Don't miss that fascinating conversation. Just go to occultofpersonality.net/membership and sign up if you haven't already. It's the best way to support the podcast while receiving access to a tremendous amount of additional exclusive content. Thanks again for listening, and until next time. Thank you.
everyone.